Perhaps this is a radical statement, but I think I've come to learn that an existentialist is somebody who is asking the right questions. They're asking, what is the meaning of my existence? What is spirituality? What is important? Why am I living here? We cannot ask more important questions than those.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
We are on our quest to continue to try and understand biblical spirituality. What is it, and what does it look like in our lives? And today what we're going to do is look at the philosopher Kierkegaard. And Jack, I really hardly know anything about Kierkegaard. I was telling you before this show that I had listened to one of your tapes, but I couldn't find it this week to review it, so you're kind of on. It's up to you, and I'll just ask a lot of questions and be quite a student.
Okay.
You know, some people in our audience might think, oh, bummer, Kierkegaard, why would I want to listen about him? Maybe I'll just kind of flip the channel at this point. But you guys, wait a minute. Let's let Jack tell us why in the world we would want to think about talking about this philosopher.
Okay. Kierkegaard was a Danish philosopher who wrote in the 1800s. He was very influential in the history of ideas in our culture, although not, I don't think his name is a household word for most people, unless they have had some philosophy classes or English classes or something at the university. They may have never heard of him.
Though, Jack, didn't he coin the word existential, which
he,
is kind of
did.
An household word these
yes,
days?
Yes, yeah, he did. He coined that term, right. I was, of course, a philosophy major in college, and so I ran into him relatively early in my university career. And my initial reaction was that this was not anybody that I really wanted to listen to. The way that he was taught to me, the ideas that my teachers suggested represented his viewpoints seemed to be completely antithetical to biblical Christianity. And then my next exposure to Kierkegaard was through Francis Schaeffer. Francis Schaeffer, back when he was lecturing on college campuses, his material that made it into the book, the two books, Escape from Reason and The God Who Is There, he represents Kierkegaard as being a kind of an important watershed in the history of ideas, where Kierkegaard introduced the irrational faith as the irrational, as being a really important move in the wrong direction in our society. So if anybody's familiar with Schaeffer's thought, Kierkegaard is one of the bad guys, as Schaeffer sees it. And that made sense to me because of the way Kierkegaard had been taught to me. It made sense to me to see him as kind of one of the bad guys.
The bad guys in the sense that he was a rebel to Christianity.
Yeah, that his ideas were really destructive of the foundations of what our faith is really all about. I'll come back to that. I'll talk about that more in a little bit. But it wasn't until I was in graduate school and I was a teaching assistant in a class on existentialism where I actually read a significant amount of Kierkegaard for that class and led discussions on it with the students. And what was significant is I didn't go back to graduate school until later in my life, so I had had a number of years as a Bible student in between my undergraduate degree and my graduate degree. I had been teaching the Bible for, 15, 20 years by that time. And my whole idea about what the Bible was teaching about the faith was transformed during that time. So I came back to Kierkegaard with a much more mature understanding of the New Testament and our faith than I had had when I was first exposed to him. And it was astounding because I was reading this philosopher and he sounded like the Apostle Paul and like Jesus and like the New Testament. And not only that, but I recognized that most of his ideas were rooted in various passages in the New Testament. It was very clear that he was taking language from the New Testament, ideas from the New Testament, and was just expanding on them. He was really a student of the Bible.
Must have really surprised you.
It did. I mean, it shocked me, because I had this stereotype of what Kierkegaard was all about, and he was getting around that stereotype and telling me, whoa.
Okay, so this is what I would have done at that point. I would have then questioned my own thinking ability, because I would have gone back and thought, oh, I must be wrong, because Francis Schaeffer, who's a great intellect, thought Kierkegaard wasn't any good, so I must just be thinking incorrectly. Do you ever go in that direction, kind of question your own thought process?
Well, I don't anymore. I would have earlier in my life, but anymore I have gained enough confidence in my ability to interpret language, to exegete people, that if I see it for myself, then if somebody disagrees with me, then I'm not sure why they don't see it, but I think I see it right in front of me, so what do I do with that? And I just have to assess it. In this case, it was relatively easy because I remembered at the time, before Schaeffer was a known quantity in this culture, I was on a campus where I was one of the first campuses that Schaeffer visited, came over from Switzerland, and he gave a series of lectures at various college campuses across the country, and we were one of the first campuses he visited.
And you were at Stanford at that time?
Yeah, and I had never heard of the guy. I was just walking across campus, and somebody came and said, there's this lecture happening tonight, do you want to come? Sounded interesting, so I went, and I'd never heard of him. But I was just absolutely fascinated. I mean, Schaeffer had a huge impact on my life. But I remember there, a senior, I was a sophomore, and a senior who was the head of our InterVarsity Christian Fellowship that I was a part of, he was a philosophy major as well, and he got into a real serious battle, debate, discussion with Schaeffer after his lecture about Kierkegaard. And that was really etched into my brain, because I remember that whole debate and the issues of that debate. And the senior was arguing that Kierkegaard was a Christian. And Schaeffer was arguing, yes, that may very well be, I'm not denying that, but his ideas were very detrimental in the history of ideas. So that distinction was very clear to me, that Schaeffer was not necessarily challenging the legitimacy of Kierkegaard's faith, he was just challenging the impact that his theology had had, or his philosophy had had. And then I went back and I read his book, The God Who Is There, Schaeffer's book. He only has one short paragraph on Kierkegaard, and in that paragraph he has a disclaimer. Says, I'm not questioning the legitimacy of Kierkegaard's faith. What I'm suggesting is his ideas had this kind of impact. And in that regard, I think Schaeffer was actually right about that. That is, Kierkegaard's ideas, given the way that they were interpreted by people like Karl Barth, by people like Sartre, Heidegger, and the other existentialists that followed, it's true that Kierkegaard's ideas got used to take culture in a very bad direction.
But
I think that's true.
I think what you're saying is that perhaps he was misunderstood.
But he was misinterpreted, exactly. That he was not saying what they were claiming he was saying.
So these other philosophers like Sartre would have perhaps not come from as solid a biblical base as they could have to understand Kierkegaard from a biblical perspective?
Right. And in all likelihood, they didn't want to understand him from that perspective, because Sartre, for example, is a thoroughgoing atheist, a thoroughgoing relativist. We make up our own reality. We invent our own reality. Reality is to us what we decide that it is.
So he would have used Kierkegaard to his advantage.
Yeah, to try to support that kind of...
And Kierkegaard is hard enough to understand. He's obtuse enough. I know that about him.
Yes.
And very deep. And I think he must have had an incredibly huge emotional life.
Yes, that, very much so.
That influenced his writings, that it was easy to go either way with him.
Yeah. Yeah, he describes himself at some point. He says, I'm not a philosopher, I'm a poet, in one of his writings. And he's using a lot of hyperbole, you know, exaggeration. He'll make this claim, this really shocking claim, like he says at one point, there's one little short sentence, truth is subjectivity. We'll talk about what that means a little bit later, but that's the kind of thing that Schaefer was looking at. Truth is subjectivity.
Whoa, way off.
A challenge of the objectivity of truth and the truth of objective reality. It sounds like that could be what Kierkegaard is saying. I'm going to argue that's not what he means at all.
He would define subjectivity very, very differently. Use it in a whole different context than we do today. Is that
right?
My memory.
Right, exactly. And why doesn't he explain that? You know, why doesn't he make the right distinctions? Why doesn't he be clearer?
Why doesn't he make it a whole lot easier for us?
And I think his answer would be, look, I'm not trying to be clear. I'm trying to have an impact. I'm a poet. Yes, this is an exaggeration. Of course it's an exaggeration. But it's an exaggeration with an intended effect. And all of his writings are carefully crafted literary works, intended not just for the philosophy that he wants to convey, but for a certain impact and a certain effect. And whether he has been successful or not, people could debate. But in order to interpret him, we need to recognize what kind of thing he's doing. And part of the challenge of interpreting him is recognizing that I can't take what he's saying just strictly at face value. I have to ask myself the question, where is he coming from? Where does he want to get me here? What is he really trying to do? And once we take that into account, I think we recognize that a lot of the statements that he made that seem so outrageous and so objectionable are actually very profound instead. And I've come to the conclusion, and I still am not, I have to make a disclaimer here, I'm not a Kierkegaard scholar. I'm a fairly casual student of Kierkegaard who has just become really enamored by his stuff, and I want to study more and I want to learn more because I think he has a lot to offer us.
Okay, so Jack, the answer to the question of why in the world are we even talking about him, I think what I'm hearing from you between the lines is because you think he, seen in the correct light, has some very good insights into our faith,
right,
into what is spirituality. He was a man who lived on a plane that was really trying to search for who is God and what does God look like in my life. And he said it in very poetic, very difficult to understand ways.
Right. My assessment right now, and if somebody could persuade me otherwise, I'd be willing to be persuaded, but my assessment right now is that Kierkegaard understands the dynamics of the Christian faith and the nature of Christian spirituality as well as, if not better, than any Christian thinker since apostolic times.
Well, that's quite a statement.
Yeah. If that's true, then obviously that's somebody we should pay attention to.
He's better than a Schaefer or a Lewis.
Yeah, he is. I'm not saying he understands Christianity better, but he understands the inner dynamics of spirituality better than anybody.
It seems like he really had an understanding of his own heart.
Right.
That he was a man who had suffered so much on an emotional level that it seems like he had been forced to ask some questions that really make sense and really made him challenge and come up against things that we might take for granted. He just couldn't, and he didn't.
Right. Yeah. And I think the other thing that intrigues me about him is that I feel a kindred spirit with Kierkegaard, much to my surprise and delight. You know, having years and years and years kind of dismissed him as one of the bad guys, to come back and read his stuff and go, whoa, he's arrived at the same place that I'm arriving. I mean, we've studied the same book and we're seeing the same thing here. This is exciting.
Cool. This is very exciting.
Yeah. And so that's part of what's intrigued me, is to find somebody several hundred years apart that I can relate to so profoundly and so...
Wouldn't you just love to talk to him?
Oh,
to go
yeah.
knock
yeah.
on his door and say, let's sit down.
Yeah.
Oh, it would be fabulous.
Have him say, who are you?
That's okay. I'll tell you about me. Can I sit for a week?
So that's why I'm interested in, that's why I think that he's worth listening to.
When did he die, Jack?
Oh. I'm not sure. Late 1800s, I think. 1870s, I think. I'm terrible with dates, so don't quote me.
I didn't
me on
ask that,
that
question. Okay, let's
go on.
Yeah,
you didn't ask that question.
Let's get into the guts of it.
Okay. I suppose the place to start is he invented this term existentialism. We need to clear the decks here first. What is existentialism, and why can it be a good thing when we have been accustomed as Christians in our contemporary Christian culture to see existentialism as antithetical to faith? Why can an existentialist also be a Christian? It was actually the professor of my existentialism class who really helped me in this regard, because I had really not understood what made existentialism existentialism. You know, for all of my training in philosophy, I'd never really got a grasp of what made existentialism existentialism.
I'm glad to hear that, Jack, because that word eludes me.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's very subtle. What fakes us out is mostly we're accustomed to thinking of isms as defining a certain set of doctrines or beliefs or perspectives, that this ism believes this, and this ism believes this, and this ism believes this other thing. So we're set up to think existentialism, oh, well, what does existentialism believe? Well, existentialism isn't that sort of thing. It's not that it believes a certain set of things. It's defined differently. What makes an existentialist is the fact that they have a certain perspective on the role of philosophy, one, and secondly, they have a certain set of emphases that become characteristic emphases in their thought. Their doctrines between different existentialists may be worlds apart. So on the one hand, you can have a Kierkegaard, or for that matter a Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist, who are Christians and who have a Christian worldview.
You're making quite a step just to put Dostoevsky,
uh-huh.
That guy, the Russian, together with Kierkegaard. I mean, just going there is a big step.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Because Mr. D is such a big hero for us Christians.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think they have very, very common perspectives there's a lot of commonality between Kierkegaard and Dostoevsky, I think.
Anyway, you were saying there's a big continuum of existentialism.
Right.
On one hand.
So on the one hand, you have those guys who, I would argue, believe in objective truth, believe in objective reality, believe that there's a right way to live your life and a wrong way to live your life. Everything that a biblical perspective on life says is really a part of their underlying worldview. So the body of beliefs that define their thinking is really basically the biblical worldview. They may have some departures here and there, but for the most part, it's a biblical worldview. On the other hand, you have Nietzsche, who, if he lived today, I would say is the Antichrist himself.
Really?
I mean, he's just about as... He is as Antichrist, as explicitly Antichrist as you could get among philosophers.
Now, wouldn't he be considered a nihilist?
Uh-huh. He is considered a nihilist as well as an existentialist, I think. I mean, there's a lot of his themes are very much in line with existentialism. Heidegger, who is clearly not a believer, clearly does not believe a biblical worldview or anything like a biblical worldview. Sartre, we've already mentioned, is a thoroughgoing atheist, thoroughgoing relativist, does not believe in objective truth at all. And that we typically, when we think of existentialists, we think of a Sartrean existentialism or a Heidegger or a Nietzsche. And those are the people we identify with existentialism. And they, of course, are antithetical to a biblical worldview and antithetical to Christianity. Clearly they are. But what they have in common, the reason they are all existentialists, even though one is an atheist and one is a Christian, what makes them existentialist is these certain specific features that I will define. First of all, what all of them can agree is that the really important role and the really important task for philosophy is to come to terms with those questions about the meaning, the purpose, and the nature of human existence. Kierkegaard coined the term existentialism based on the root idea of existence, and by existence, he didn't have in mind existence in general. He had in mind your and my existence as human beings, and not just human existence, but my individual human existence, my Jack's existence. And so what someone like Kierkegaard would say is, what's the whole point of philosophy? Jack, isn't it so you can figure out your life? So you can figure out your existence? What is it about? What is it for? What is its purpose? What is its meaning? What is its nature? What are you going to do with it? You got it. What are you going to do with it? And isn't the only really important role of philosophy is to help me come to terms with those questions? Who cares how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Who cares what the real nature of the stuff that angels is made out of is? Metaphysical speculation, which had predominated in philosophy throughout most of human history, was just not interesting to someone like Kierkegaard. They're not interested in the really weird esoteric speculations of the metaphysicians. And so they're
so
really
he was really down to earth. He was really practical. He was saying, let's look at what my life is about and why I have it and what I'm going to do with it. And that's what all those other philosophers did too. They just came to very different conclusions about what the meaning of my life is.
Right.
But it's a good question. It's an important question. I mean, why, bottom line, ask any other question?
Right. It's the question of all questions. So just the thing to keep in mind whenever you hear the term existentialism or existential or existentialist, think existence, then think human existence, then think my own particular individual human existence. What they're talking about is this has to do with me and my existence somehow, and the questions that revolve around that. That's how to translate existentialism, existentialist, anytime you confront it.
Okay, that makes it really easy. He was saying, let's take our heads out of the sky. Let's not look at this metaphysical nonsense that really doesn't address anything that has that much meaning, and let's look at what my life is all about.
Right, precisely. So that's part of, that's the essential meaning of existentialism, is having to do with the meaning and nature and purpose of my own individual existence.
So can I ask the next question?
Sure.
So how did Kierkegaard answer that question?
Well, he answered that by saying it's all about Jesus, essentially. He phrased it in weird, unfamiliar ways. It's making an infinite commitment. It's having an infinite passion for the infinite, he says. And by the infinite, he means God and the things of God, the things that pertain to God. And by an infinite commitment, he means what we learned in the Beatitudes, blessed are those who are pure in heart, an unchallenged commitment, uncompromised commitment, a commitment that is not in any way limited by my commitments to other things. I'm committed to God and the things of God above and beyond my commitment to anything else. Nothing else can come in and compete with it, that this is what my life is all about, pure and simple. And then he saw that to be the paradox and he called it the absurdity of Jesus, the incarnation, was central to how I make my infinite commitment to the infinite. But we can talk about more about that in a little bit. The bottom line is, it's to the gospel. He believed that the gospel is the right way to define the meaning and purpose and nature of my existence. I need to make my individual existence about the things of the gospel. He didn't use that language, but that's what he was saying. Unlike someone like Sartre, who comes along and says, it really doesn't make any difference what you make your life about. You just got to get on with the task and do it, and make an infinite commitment to whatever it is you want to make your commitment to. It's pretty much up to each individual what they want to make their commitment to. Doesn't really matter what, but you got to make a commitment.
Where Kierkegaard was very definite.
Yeah, very very clear about the wise choice is to do this.
To commit yourself to the gospel.
Yeah. But he recognized that we have a freedom to not do that. That was very clear in him as well, is that if you want to be foolish, you're free to be foolish. You're free to make a commitment to lesser things, and no one's going to stop you. You and only you are going to define your existence by the by the commitments that you make. So you better take those commitments pretty seriously. You better recognize that you're defining your entire existence by the choice you make. And that's what he does have in common with Sartre, is a recognition of the burden of responsibility for defining my own existence by my choices and commitments. He would agree with Sartre on that. But unlike Sartre, he thinks that there's a clearly wise way to discharge that responsibility and a lot of foolish ways to discharge that responsibility.
So there's no way in which Kierkegaard was a relativist like Sartre?
Not at all. I'm convinced that he was not. Yeah.
Or a nihilist like Nietzsche?
No.
He really saw meaning and purpose and good in life, even through all the pain of his life.
Right.
I think he really had to swim through a lot of currents, go in the opposite direction to come to the conclusions that he did. I don't think he did it simply or without incredible struggle, just
right.
Given the little bit that I've read and the painful perspective of his writings.
Right. A lot of agony comes through. A lot of self-inflicted pain, I mean self-torture, that he went through trying to resolve the issues of his own life. And he was a very, very tortured individual in a lot of ways. But so was Nietzsche. But Nietzsche's writings are full of whining about his torture. You don't have that same sense of in Kierkegaard that this is a whiner who is putting all of his anguish out there for you to feel sorry for him.
He was a courageous explorer.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure I agree. Here I am disagreeing with you on something with Kierkegaard. Oh, well. That he had self-inflicted torture. It sounds like he was tortured, and he had to work with what was on his plate. And he worked hard and courageously upstream.
Yeah. Well, what I mean by self-inflicted is it wasn't famine, it wasn't persecution, it wasn't stuff coming from his environment. It was emotional, psychological. It was coming from inside. It was stuff having to deal with the inner realities of his life that filled him with anguish. It wasn't dealing with external pressures.
But Jack, I would say that the external was what created the emotional agony in his life, and ultimately you do have to deal with the external when you're dealing with the internal agony.
Okay, yeah.
I'm really going for that because, of course, I have this bent of working with people who have been so painfully, agonizingly hurt, and to call it self-inflicted, I think would be a real challenge to the courage that they display in trying to face up and into these issues in their lives.
Okay,
it's not because they're choosing them, it's because they're there and they're deciding not to be whiners, they're deciding to be people who stand up and work against what looks absolutely and
right.
completely impossible.
Yeah, that's a good point. I buy that. So the second way that you can look at what makes existentialism are a certain set of themes. Existentialists really make a big deal out of the freedom that we as individuals have to define ourselves by our commitments. That's an important theme that crops up in every existentialist, regardless of their worldview. The burden of the responsibility for doing that is a really important theme. The idea that the choice in defining my existence is mine, and I don't have the right to try to slough that responsibility off on somebody else. That's probably the only good thing Nietzsche said, but Nietzsche said that as well as anybody else, where he emphasized the importance of being an individual, have the strength of my individuality intact enough that I take responsibility for my life. I don't just melt into the herd and conform for the sake of conformity and melt into the safety of the group, but I stand alone and I stand apart making my commitments because I want them to be my commitments. I think that's the only good thing Nietzsche ever said, but what he is saying loudly is clearly an important theme in someone like Kierkegaard or Sartre or any of the other existentialists as well. So those are the characteristics that kind of stand out when you read the existentialists, is you keep running into these themes about you're free to define yourself, take responsibility for that, do it, be an individual, stand up, be an individual, and decide what you want your life to be all about and do it. Now, when you put it that way, now we go back and we recognize Kierkegaard did not invent existentialism. Existentialism is really ancient. Those themes you find in the prophets of Israel, the ancient prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Israel, decide which day you will go, decide whom you will serve.
So we could say that God is an existentialist.
God is an existentialist, yeah. Because he's the one who's, through his prophets, constantly confronting us. You, as individual people, have a choice to make. And your choice is going to define your existence. It's going to define your destiny. It's going to define your relationship to me. And you have to make the choice. You and only you can define what that destiny and that relationship is going to be all about. That's the existentialist appeal. Jesus was clearly an existentialist in that sense. You cannot serve two masters. Either you will love the one and hate the other, or you will hate the one and love the other, however he said that. You have a choice to make today. Choose which is going to be your master. That's an existential choice. We're faced with a lot of choices today. Am I going to shop at Albertsons or Safeway? Am I going to shop at this store or that store? Am I going to buy this product or that product, this brand or that brand? Those are not existential choices, though. They could be, but they're typically not existential choices. And what I mean by that is they're not typically choices that I'm making where they're a weighty choice because the choice I'm making is actually defining my existence for me. An existential choice is a choice that I'm making, and I'm making out of my freedom, but the import of the choice is that I can't make this choice without actually defining the meaning and purpose of my existence by making that choice. Jesus was calling on people to make choices that were ultimately going to define their destiny by the choice that they made. He's calling them to an existential choice.
So God, way back in the prophets, asked us to make an existential choice, which means look at what is the meaning of your life and go for it.
Right.
If you want to follow me, then follow me with all your heart. If you're not, then you're not. Jesus came along later and said, who do you want to follow? What's going to be the meaning of your life? Are you going to give up mother and sister, brother, mom and dad, and follow me and take up your cross and go through the suffering to do that? Is that the kind of meaning you're going to have? Or are you going to go down the easy road and decide not to make that the meaning of your life? And Kierkegaard then was another person that came along and said, wow, those were really important questions, and I'm going to apply that to my own life. As difficult as it is to do that, as hard as that road is for me, I'm going to really work toward doing that. So in a sense, he was also our mentor.
Right, right.
But he just came from a very difficult place to do that.
And it's helpful to understand the context in which he's writing. He's writing at a time where in Denmark there is a state church, basically a Lutheran church. Everybody who's born in Denmark becomes a Christian. Everybody who's born is a Lutheran and belongs to the church, and they live these smug, hypocritical little lives. They've never had to make they've never had a defining moment in their lives where in that defining moment they decided to follow Jesus. They were born following Jesus. And that's what he's calling into question. What he's saying is, as I read the New Testament, I don't really see any place for people being born Christians. The only kind of Christian that I see, the only kind of disciple of Jesus that I see in the New Testament, are people who have an infinite passion for the infinite. Are people who've...
They're not complacent people.
Right.
They're people who are really pressing forward to that, ask these questions in ways that really have meaning. And that would have meant a lot more conflict in his life, because he would have been going really not just up against the flow in his own heart, in his own agonized life, but also up against the flow of the entire culture
his
in which
whole
he
society.
Lived.
Exactly. Yeah, the whole nation. And he was seen as a real renegade by his contemporaries. His other hero besides Jesus, he talks about two heroes. One is Jesus and the other is Socrates, which is also amazing to me because that's been my own experience. I've discovered Socrates as well as just a phenomenal thinker who was also an existentialist. I mean, that's what's so striking about Socrates. In a time when metaphysical speculation is a huge big deal, he's saying, I think the really important questions that we need to be asking is, do we know what we're doing in our lives?
Let's get down to earth.
Yeah, let's get down to earth and figure out what my life should be all about. And that was clearly Socrates' emphasis. And I think it's, in that regard, you see Kierkegaard as a real student of Socrates, and that would be. And there were other existentialists. Augustine was an existentialist. Luther was an existentialist. Calvin was an existentialist. But the followers of all these people have a tendency, that's the real struggle of our lives, is to remain existentialists and not become members of some religious society instead. It's so easy to turn our Christianity not into this individualistic existential thing, but into this group thing where we form a community together, get institutionalized, get organized, get established, and just become this thing that I don't have to think about any longer, that has a momentum of its own. I don't have to face myself. I don't have to ask myself any questions. I don't have to ask any hard questions. I don't have to challenge myself. I just am there by virtue of my belonging, and that takes care of itself. That's the very thing that is driving Kierkegaard crazy. Here are all these people who belong to the church, and none of them are Christians.
And that it has no personal meaning, and that they really haven't made a commitment to God out of an understanding of their need for Him.
Yeah.
They've just kind of gone along with the flow.
Right. And what he's saying is, it can't work that way. Nobody can enter the kingdom of God by going with the flow. You're not going to get there that way. He has a whole work that is titled Attack on Christendom. I mean, he saw himself as a real critic, maybe even enemy, of the church. And what I mean is the State Church of Denmark. He was an enemy of the State Church of Denmark because he saw it as not helping people into the kingdom of God, but keeping them from getting there, because it allowed them to never ask themselves the questions that had to be answered if you were going to be a disciple of Jesus at all.
It allowed them just to stay in the fog. The fog that never defined anything personally about their lives. So let me bring this down to earth a little bit more. And perhaps we're pounding these points in a little bit too much, but I'll try one more time. Kierkegaard was saying to the established church of his time, come on, you guys, let's get out of this complacent fog. It might lead us to hell because we're not thinking about the important questions of what the meaning of our lives are about. You guys, the meaning of our lives are about freely choosing Jesus as Savior and understanding the impact and the import of his message in our personal lives. Wake up, look, think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. When you see it that way, when you recognize that that's what he's saying, it's hard to understand why anybody would ever have had any objection to Kierkegaard. And that, you know, that was certainly my reaction once I read him. But remember, I'm interpreting him. I mean, remember that his language is not. He invents his own language to describe these things,
mm-hmm.
And that's what led people to be capable of misinterpreting him if they wanted to.
Like the example you used, which I think is a really great one, is truth is subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be a good time for us to go there now, Jack?
Okay, sure.
So, how did he define subjectivity? What is our subjectivity?
As I understand what he means by subjectivity is he's inventing a word to try to capture all of that stuff deep down inside the person that I am that really ultimately characterizes me as an individual, that defines me as an individual. My beliefs, my perceptions, my desires and passions, the things that make me tick, the things that drive me, the things that motivate me, my values, my priorities, probably other things we could put in there. But rather than define this long list of things deep down inside of us that really define us, he just used one word to try to capture all of that. And what he called it is my subjectivity. My subjectivity just is the inward person that I am. So I think if we were to use a New Testament word, his term subjectivity means the same thing that Paul means by heart when he talks about my heart, the heart of a person, or the apostles call our spirit when it refers to the spirit of a man. Those are the two that come readily to mind. There might be other terms, Paul at one point uses the term the inner man. He uses the term inner man to describe that. What Paul means by inner man is what Kierkegaard is calling subjectivity. It comes from the word subject, that is, I am this subject, one who knows, one who thinks, one who desires, one who believes. I'm the subject of all my beliefs and desires and knowledge and so on. And subjectivity is just that stuff inside that makes me the particular subject that I am, the particular individual, the particular person that I am. It's not my body, it's not the trappings, the social trappings, it's not what I wear, it's not what I own, it's not the external stuff of my life, it's the internal stuff of my life, the stuff that really drives me from the inside and makes me tick. Whatever that is my subjectivity. So, when he makes the claim, truth is subjectivity, what he means by that, he's not really defining truth. What he's defining are people who are affiliated with the truth, people who are defined by the truth, people who are associated with the truth. I mean, every Christian knows that it's by being affiliated with the truth that I am a believer, that I am justified, that my sins are forgiven, that I'm rightly related to God. Well, the problem is the State Church of Denmark says, sign your name on the register when you're born, and go to catechism and confess in catechism that you believe in this creed and you are rightly affiliated with the truth. We, the church, are the possessors of the truth. You can have it if you join us. And by joining us, you do have the truth.
Are
affiliated with the truth.
He was just in such trouble because, in essence, what they were saying was the opposite of what he was saying. They were saying it's these external things that you have. You're born in this country. You sign this paper. You do these things, and that makes you a believer.
Right.
He was saying the opposite. What defines you is the inner man, the heart, the soul, as Paul said. And let's forget all these outer trappings, basically. If you don't have this inner heart that has a passion for God, that is, what did you say earlier? It's an infinite commitment to the infinite.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real passion for God that's internal. Then you don't have anything, buddy.
Exactly.
Oh, man, he was in trouble, wasn't he?
Right, yeah.
Did they excommunicate him from the Lutheran Church? Did he get burnt at the stake?
Actually, no, I think he was still preaching sermons in the churches at the end of his days, I think. I don't know his autobiography all that well, but I know he caught a lot of flack. He was very controversial. But yes, you got it. You nailed it. That's exactly what he means by that claim. Truth is subjectivity. He's asking the question, who is of the truth? Well, to answer that question, recognize that truth is subjectivity. To be of the truth is to be of the truth from the inside, not just in some kind of external conformity of your life to a creed or to an institution. Truth has to do with the inner condition of your heart, your spirit, your inner man. It's the commitments that the inner man has made that defines you as either being of the truth or not. But you can see how confusing that statement is, because grammatically it has the form as if it's actually defining what truth is. We can't pay attention to the grammar because this is poetry. You know, this is not a precise philosophical definition. This is a poet giving us poetry to try to have an impact. In contrast to the statement or the slogan, truth is the Danish state church, he's saying, no, truth is subjectivity. So I hope that's clear. But that's a good example of the way in which he is commonly misinterpreted as a champion of irrational faith. That's how he's commonly interpreted. And you can see why, because he makes statements like that and other statements that we could look at. But that's not what he means by those. Let me give another example. He talks about faith involving embracing absurdity. Well, you know, someone like Schaefer has a field day with that. I mean, he has a cow. You're claiming that our faith is ultimately absurd and that there's some virtue in embracing what is absurd. That's crazy. That's making our faith irrational. Where Schaefer is right, that would be crazy to define faith that way. And Schaefer's concerns are absolutely right, and I of all people share Schaefer's concerns in that regard completely. We don't ever want to fall into the trap of thinking that faith is somehow contrary to reason, is different than reason, is another way of knowing, and that it's this irrational way of knowing, and oh, what a glorious, virtuous thing it is, this irrationality of faith. Somebody was telling me the other day they were listening to Christian radio on the radio, on their car radio, and the quote of the day came on. And the quote of the day was, "The more you know, the less faith you have."
You must have screamed.
Oh, man. I mean, that's terrible. That's exactly, that is a pithy statement of everything that's wrong with our understanding of faith in this culture. And Schaefer would have died at that statement, and I agree with Schaefer. That's terrible, terrible, terrible sentiment. The more we know, if we know truly, the greater is our faith, not the less is our faith. But there is a sentiment out there that faith is somehow different than reason, somehow different than knowledge. It's another way of knowing, and we need to learn that other way of knowing.
You know, we received a letter. Somebody was talking about this. I'm going to get it out real quickly and read.
Sure.
Now, this is a person that really wrote in earnest. He wrote 3 or 4 pages, really a small printing, used up the whole page, and was very earnest about what he was saying, and is very much taking what he is saying seriously. He says, "Most seek understanding of that which is spiritual by intellectual means. I've come to realize that Christ has chosen to not allow anything spiritual to be grasped through the intellect," and he capitalizes these words, "at all. Intelligence is a total hindrance to spiritual understanding."
That's what Schaefer, in part, was fighting against. That's what I have spent much of my teaching ministry fighting against. I think that's completely wrong. Actually, I should say, I appreciate the letter. The spirit of the letter is wonderful. There are a lot of insights in the letter. I'm not sure that this letter writer ultimately even believes that statement that he just made, because he's obviously a very thoughtful, intelligent
really
man
using his intellect.
Who is using his intellect to really try to come to terms with his faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very unfortunate that there's this tension between what he's actually doing, which is right, which is to give the God-given intellect that he gave him to come to know his Creator and his Lord, and the authoritative revelation of God's Word in the Bible better. He's practicing the very thing that Schaefer and I would applaud and would recommend. But he has this sentiment that our culture is very, very steeped in, that somehow my mind is my enemy, my reason is my enemy, and I can't come to faith by using my intellect and my mind. I just don't think that's right. And if Kierkegaard were saying that, then shame on Kierkegaard. But what I will argue, and perhaps we'll have to continue this in another session, is that that's not what Kierkegaard meant at all. And we'll have to talk about later about what he actually did mean.
Yeah, and I have to say that we're at the very end of our program, and I'm disappointed in that, because you made a statement about irrationality and absurdity of the faith. Those are really big words. And we can't now, at the end of this program, really define them. And I'm kind of have ants in my pants thinking, oh, no, we need to do that. So definitely we're going to have to come back to it next time. This has been a fascinating discussion for me. It's very practical. I think the most practical philosophical discussion I've ever had. I could never get in my philosophy classes why we were bothering trying to figure out the ridiculous things that they were asking us. They
uh-huh.
were metaphysical, and they didn't have anything to do with my life.
Yeah.
And certainly Kierkegaard has everything to do with my life. He was asking the questions that I value so much.
Yeah, that's why I like him.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask, ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, Mackenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call McKenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
We're kind of taking a break in the middle of the program now to talk about the financial needs of Christianity at Work. So, Jack, you've been on financial support for how many years in your life?
20 years. Almost 20 years now.
Wow. You had to stop and think about that.
Yeah.
That's a really long time.
Yeah, it is.
Maybe it's too long now that you think of it.
Yeah.
I think that if I was on financial support for 20 years, I might feel a little bit worn down on the seams. Do you ever feel that way?
Well, I mostly don't think about it. God has been so faithful and has seen us through many a crisis, and I kind of am at a point now where I don't consider my financial situation really any more vulnerable than anybody's paycheck. I mean, anything could happen to anybody, and I'm really not in any different kind of situation. The only difference between me and the typical worker for a wage is that I know how vulnerable my financial situation is. I mean, I'm faced with that monthly. If the money isn't given out of the generosity of my supporters' hearts, then it ain't going to be there. And I'm very keenly aware of that. But God has been so faithful over the years that we haven't got rich, but we haven't gone without. So there's a tremendous amount of security in what God has shown to be his commitment to us.
So, and I guess in answer to my question, are you kind of worn out? Your answer is no.
Well, I guess not, yeah.
You're not sitting on the edge of your seat.
There are times where I literally don't know if I'm going to have an adequate paycheck the next month, where the thought crosses my mind, why do you do this? Why don't you just go out and get a job? But I believe in what I'm doing, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
And how do you apply that to Christianity at Work?
Well, I suppose what carries over is that I wouldn't want anybody to think that supporting me, or in this case our program, is their responsibility. I've always taken this attitude, but as I've studied the New Testament, what I've learned is I have to assume responsibility for the financial well-being of myself and my family. So I would take the same attitude toward this program, is that we don't want to twist people's arms and say, you know, you're a bad Christian if you don't support Christianity at Work. That I really don't believe that. I think people can benefit greatly from this program and have different commitments and make contributions to other places. The issue biblically is just the generosity of spirit, not are you supporting our program. But we would hope that people would see enough value in what we're doing here that they would want to invest in this project by giving us money to buy the airtime.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mckenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of McKenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to McKenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, by 41-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.